Some other news this morning. News we're making. We're excited to announce that Morning Edition is starting a book club. We're calling it Morning Reads. Our colleague David Green is going to explain and invite you to join the club.
To kick it all off, we are asking another member, Anne Patchett, to pick our first selection. She's the author of books, including Bel Canto. She's also the co-owner of Parnassus Books, an independent bookstore in Nashville. And she's going to talk to us in just a moment. Let me tell you how this is going to work. She is going to give us a selection. You, our listeners, and all of the book club members, including myself, we're all going to read the book. You can send us your questions, and we'll reconvene here on Morning Edition in a month or so to discuss the book with the author and also Anne. So let's bring in Anne now. Anne, thanks for being here, and welcome to the book club.
I'm so glad to be here.
So what is the first book that we're all going to read together?
It's called Deep Down Dark, The Untold Stories of 33 Men Buried in a Chilean Mine and the Miracle That Set Them Free. It's a heck of a subtitle.
Yeah.
By Hector Tobar.
You almost know exactly what the book is about from the title itself, but this is going back to 2010, these 33 miners who were trapped 2,000 feet underground in a mine in Chile for 69 days, which is astounding. Tell us a little more about the book and why you think this will be a good read for us.
I love this book on two levels. It was my favorite book of the year, and I do nothing but read books. Because one, just by itself, it's a riveting story. It was riveting when we were watching it on the news. It's riveting in the book. You want to make sure these men are safe. Even though we already know they're safe, there's an enormous amount of suspense and tension how they're going to get through this. But the second half, and it's why this is an extraordinary book, is because of Hector Tobar's writing, which is so beautiful and so thoughtful that he's taking on all of the big issues of life. You know, what is life worth? What is the value of one human life? What is faith? Who do we become in our darkest hour? And he really brings this story to a level that I don't feel like anyone else could have done.
You know, we want to make this book club about the books and encourage people to read them. I have friends who are in book clubs, and oftentimes they say it becomes just a social gathering. People don't actually read the books, and sometimes bad books are recommended. I mean, what makes a book right for a group to sort of read together and explore together?
I can tell you what the answer is for me, but that certainly isn't the answer for all book clubs. And I've got no problem with people who use a book as an excuse to get together and have fun and socialize. Mm-hmm. I think that's fine. Yeah.
People are nodding and saying, thank you for saying that out there. I can hear them right now.
But for me, I want to discuss a book that I feel like I would benefit from other people's insights. You don't need to have a book club and get together and discuss Gone with the Wind. You can really figure that one out all by yourself. But a book like Deep Down Dark, we're all going to say, oh, you know, I didn't think about that. It wasn't that way for me. I was talking about this book with a couple of people that I know recently, and we were talking about at what point in the book we cried. Now, I'm somebody who cries maybe once every 2 years. I'm just not a crier.
Wow.
But I cried when I read this book, and I've cried maybe in three books in my life. But when I was talking about that with this group of people, we had all cried at a different point. We had all been just unbelievably moved by something different. And that, to me, is what makes a book a great book club book.
All right. Well, you talk about people bringing their own insights and questions, and let's describe to our listeners how they can do just that. Over the next few weeks, you can send us your questions on the Morning Edition Facebook page, or you can tweet them to us, hashtag Morning Reads. And when our club meets in a month, your question might be read on air.
And everybody, read this book. All you NPR people, read the book. It's the best book of the year.
How can you say no to that? Deep Down Dark, recommended by author Anne Patchett, who spoke with our own David Green. Anne Patchett will join us, along with the author Hector Tobar, when we reconvene our book club in a month or so. Let's hear a tale of books going to war. Lots and lots of books. 73 years ago this week, President Franklin D. Roosevelt spoke of a date which will live in infamy.
The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan.
After Pearl Harbor, millions of Americans would leave home to fight in Europe and the Pacific. Comforts would be few, and there would be little in the way of escape or entertainment.
One much-prized item, then, tiny books.
During World War II, American publishers wanted to do their part to support the troops, and so they decided that the best they could do was print miniature paperback books that were small enough that they could fit in a pocket so the men could carry these books with them anywhere.
That's Molly Guptill Manning, who has just written a history of those books. They were known as Armed Services Editions and included a wide array of titles. There was Charles Dickens and there was Shakespeare, plus mysteries, and also westerns like Harvard Has a Homicide and Six Gun Showdown. The project came out of earlier efforts to get used books to servicemen. With Nazis banning and burning books over in Europe, horrified American librarians took action.
They thought that they should host book drives to collect as many books as they could so that the Americans who might end up facing the German army would arm their minds with ideas.
And that, by the way, is sort of how they put it, arm their minds.
Exactly.
Well-intentioned, though they were, results of those book drives were mixed, attracting titles like How to Knit and Theology in 1870. So the focus switched to designing and printing books soldiers actually wanted to read. No easy task, since these armed services editions had to be battlefield ready.
They were about the size of a smartphone, and they were tucked into the pockets of uniforms. The paper that they were printed on was about the strength of newsprint, and so it was believed that each book would probably withstand about six readings before it would start to fall into pieces.
Although from what you write, it sounds like each book endured many more than six readings.
They did. There are actually reports of some books having waiting lists of 30 guys who wanted to read a certain book.
And one of their all-time favorites, a bittersweet tale about a young girl growing up poor but loved in early 1900s New York, A Tree Grows in Brooklyn.
This book made them think of home. Men Who Never Set Foot in Brooklyn wrote to Betty Smith, the author of A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, to say that they felt like they were reading about their hometown.
Another book along those lines with a title I think maybe nobody has ever heard of, called Chicken Every Sunday. And why was that so popular?
The book tells the story of a young girl who grew up in a boarding house where her mother entertained all sorts of zany characters and each night fed them mouth-watering dinners. And so as men were stationed around the world eating rations out of cans, to read these stories about these wonderful dinners made them think of their own mothers and the meals that they used to eat at home. It gave them a trip back home, basically. One man said it was like taking a leave.
Hmm. These were, many of them, very young men. And in the case of other popular books, how can I put this? They were popular for a specific reason, and that had to do with the steamy sex scenes. Steamy for the day, anyway.
That's right. Many men wrote in saying, we would like to read books like Strange Fruit by Lillian Smith, because, as one man said, this book has sex scenes and a lot of them.
But it also had quite a solid story about interracial romance and some difficult questions of the time. The other book that you write about, Forever Amber, seems much more like a romance novel as we would know it.
Yes, that was more of a romance novel. And actually, some of the people that were in charge of selecting the books expressed concern about sending what they called trashy books to soldiers and sailors who were fighting at war. And so top publishers in the United States were presented with the question of whether they should be sending trashy books to American troops. And the publishers said yes. They said if the men want to read trashy novels, then let's send them trashy novels.
Well, you also quote from letters throughout the book, and I wonder if you would read one of them for us. It is from a Marine who wrote to author Betty Smith after reading A Tree Grows in Brooklyn. He was touched deeply by it.
Sure. Were you ever so upset emotionally that you had to tell someone about it, to sit down and write it out? That is how I feel now. You see, I am a 20-year-old, but I feel twice that age. I went through hell in 2 years of combat overseas.
And he goes on to write about, and I'm quoting his letter, carrying a stretcher from which my buddy's life dripped away in precious blood. And how he, as he put it, felt sure that I was no longer capable of loving anything or anybody. This book, A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, it really affected him.
Yes, he talks about how he went around for 2 years with a dead heart, and he was hospitalized with malaria. He asked a nurse for a book because he was bored and had nothing else to do. She happened to give him a copy of A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, and the book just changed his entire outlook. It made him laugh. It made him cry. And he said even though a battle-hardened Marine usually doesn't cry, he was proud of his tears because it proved that he was human again. He closed the letter saying that he didn't think he'd be able to sleep through the night if he hadn't thanked the woman who caused him to live again.
Molly Guptill Manning, thank you very much.
Thank you.
She is the author of The History, When Books Went to War, The Stories That Helped Us Win World War II.
In the world of children's literature, A Bridge to Terabithia stood apart for a long time. When it was published in 1977, not many books for kids took on bullying, complicated emotions, and death in such a direct and sophisticated way. It's an unusual story from an unusual writer. Catherine Patterson was raised by Christian missionaries and was born in China. She considered China her home and lived there until the Japanese invasion during World War II.
I really think of myself as having an idyllic childhood until the age of five, or just about five, and that's when the bombing started and the invasion followed soon thereafter. And those years were very scary years.
Now, you also spent a lot of time in Japan when you were a young woman before you began writing bestsellers. What is it that took you to Japan?
I, of course, really truly longed to go back to China. And because I've of a missionary background and because I have not just inherited my parents' faith, but I have my own faith. And I had a Japanese friend in seminary, and she suggested that I go to Japan, which was a little bit horrifying for me because my memory of the Japanese was pretty scary.
Right.
And she said, well, if you give the Japanese people a chance, I think you'll get to love them. And what I learned in those 4 years I spent in Japan was how wonderful it is to be loved by people that you had thought you hated.
Yeah.
And I thought maybe everybody in the world needs to have that experience, to be loved by someone they thought they hated.
Do you feel like there's something of a missionary impulse in your writing? I don't mean so much that there's a religious message, but the desire to spread a message.
Well, you know, I try very hard to stay away from the word message because I think it's poison in fiction. I think you tell your story and then the reader gets to decide what he or she will learn from your story. And if they don't want to learn anything from it, that's their choice.
Well, let's talk about your most celebrated story, your book, and you know we would be talking about this, Bridge to Terabithia. And for those people who don't know the story, I should say there's a major spoiler, so maybe come back in a couple of minutes. The main character in the book is a girl named Leslie Burke. She's a tomboyish, clever kid. Can you talk about the girl who inspired the character?
Well, Lisa Hill, who was my son David's best friend when they were in the second grade, was in many ways like I have pictured Leslie Burke. Lisa was only 8 when she died. Actually, she was struck by lightning. So there were certainly similarities in her. She was bright, and she was funny, and she was athletic, and she was a wonderful kid. And it broke all of our hearts when she died.
And in writing Terabithia, you actually get stuck at that moment in the story, that the chapter where Leslie will die.
Yeah, the only way I could keep her alive was not to write that chapter. As I tell in the book, going to a friend's house, and the friend says, how's your book coming? And I just blurted out that I was writing a story about friendship between a boy and a girl, and, and the girl was going to die, but I couldn't let her die. And so I said to Estelle, I think I just can't face Lisa's death again. Well, Estelle knew very well that I had, in that same year, been operated on for cancer. And she said, I don't think it's Leslie's death you can't face. I think it's yours. And I realized she was absolutely right. And if that was true, that I would have to go home and finish the book because I would have to face my own death. It was a great freeing thing for me to face that death and then to move on.
There's this amazing moment, once you get the story out with your editor, which is what makes this into a book. She asks you the question, is this a story about friendship or is this a story about death?
Yes, and I think that's what a great editor does. The great editor asks the right question. And I had thought until that moment that I had written a story about death because it had been a year about death or fear of death. And as soon as she asked me the question, I knew I was wrong. And I said, oh, it's a book about friendship. And she said, well, you need to go back and write it that way. And she said, you know, in a real friendship, both friends change and grow.
You know how much this book is loved by so many people, but of course there were people who were attacked Bridge to Terabithia that didn't think that, you know, thought that death in this way was kind of a taboo subject. Did the attacks bother you or get to you at all?
Well, of course you love your own book. I certainly love my books, and it's like someone attacks your child initially, but then the more you write, the more you realize that if a book has any power, it also has the power to offend. And there were many people offended by this book, and I'm sorry because I don't like to offend people. But I know that it was a story that I had to tell, and I had to tell it in the way I told it. So I can't apologize for it. I can feel sad that it was hard for them.
And for the people who love the book, you've connected. You write it in the book how you've connected with a lot of the people who've read the book, and they share the deepest and kind of darkest parts of their own experience with you.
Yeah, I thought that was the most amazing thing that happened to me after the book was published, because it was such a personal story and such a family story that I wasn't even sure it would ever be published. You know, the most wonderful thing about being a writer is having readers. And they've taken my little story and made something really wonderful with it because they have brought to it their own lives.
Catherine Patterson is the author of so many award-winning books for young people, including Bridge to Terabithia. Her new memoir is Stories of My Life. It was so nice speaking with you, Catherine. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much. It was lovely speaking with you, too.
Most books about President Richard Nixon focus either on his foreign policies or on the crimes and misdemeanors that forced his resignation under threat of impeachment, but not Stephen Hesse's new little book called The Professor and the President. Hesse, who has been writing about government for decades out of Washington's Brookings Institution, was witness to a rare partnership inside the White House. The President, Richard Nixon, was a Republican who felt obliged to do something about welfare.
Government can do a lot of things for men. It can provide a man shelter, and it can provide him food, and it can provide him a house. It can provide him clothing, but it can't provide him dignity.
The professor was a Democrat, a Harvard sociologist whom Nixon recruited to the White House staff.
The president is going to provide, in this proposal, 150,000 training slots, training opportunities for welfare mothers, and provision for 450,000 daycare opportunities to take care of their children while they're working.
That was Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who went on to be a four-term U.S. senator from New York. Steve Hess, welcome.
Thank you.
To
Rob.
The program. And as you describe it, Daniel Patrick Moynihan, a Democrat in the White House, managed to persuade Richard Nixon to embrace a much more liberal approach to welfare than most of the Nixon White House team would ever have done. What was it for
Well, wasn't that the oddest couple you can imagine? Yeah. And fortunately, I was right there. I was a person In fact, I start the book by saying I'm the only person, I think, in the world who knew Daniel Patrick Moynihan and Richard Nixon before they knew each other.
The year was 1969.
Correct.
Nixon's first year in the White House. And it wasn't just that Nixon heard what Moynihan had to say and said, well, sure. There was an interesting debate going on in the White House, and Moynihan had some pretty heavyweight intellectual opposition within the White House.
It was really quite fascinating, because after he appointed Moynihan, the liberal Harvard Democratic social scientist, he appointed Arthur Burns, the Columbia conservative economist, and they went at it, and at the highest level, in the highest fashion, for the mind and the heart of Richard Nixon.
Of course, as you point out, what enabled Nixon to be, we'll give him the benefit of the doubt, open-minded about welfare was he didn't care. He didn't care about any domestic programs,
That's
right?
That's absolutely fascinating. Yeah, when Pat Moynihan came to the Hotel Pierre, where the transition was in New York, and met with the president-elect, and then came downstairs to have dinner with me, and said, he's ignorant, meaning he doesn't know anything about domestic affairs. I knew Richard Nixon. I had been his speechwriter when he ran for governor. I said, no, it's not. He's disinterested. Mm-hmm. He is fascinated and overwhelmed in his interest in international affairs and the place of the world. But what it meant for Pat Moynihan was he had an open slate to write upon.
And the next thing
he found out was that Richard Nixon was very smart. And once he could get to him, they developed an interesting relationship, because almost from the get-go, Richard Nixon started to be treated by Pat Moynihan as an intellectual. Mm-hmm. Nobody had ever treated him as an intellectual before, and Nixon was fascinated by it.
But there's a darker side to that story told by people who are farther away from it than you, which was it was a case of Moynihan being the artful flatterer, saying, here, read about Disraeli. Read about the artful conservative Prime Minister of Britain. You're a little bit like this man changed conservatism.
Henry Kissinger figured out how to be the courtier, too, the absolute flatterer. It looks like a flatterer to us. It didn't look like a flatterer to Richard Nixon, that's for sure. And what Pat was doing was trying to convince Nixon to be a great president. You don't go in and say you should be a great president. You say a great athlete, a great actor. You don't say a great president. So the word he used was historic. Everything that Nixon was doing, even some little thing about moving the boundaries of regional agency, historic. No president had ever done it before. And that's what he was trying to do. Remember, Pat Moynihan was born in 1929. All of his youth was FDR, Franklin Roosevelt. Yeah. That was the model of a president. And that's what he was trying to sell to Richard Nixon.
In the welfare proposal that eventually came of the Moynihan-Nixon collaboration, mm-hmm. we heard Moynihan talking about child care for working mothers. He believed in a negative income tax, didn't he? He believed that we should be what became the earned income tax credit of paying the poor money from the government.
Yeah.
These were ideas that actually went beyond what the New Deal had achieved.
Yeah, this was really quite remarkable. There was a moment in one of these cabinet debates where Arthur Burns's deputy, Marty Anderson, a very, very, very smart fellow who in the next administration became the chief domestic advisor to Ronald Reagan, slammed the table and said, this is a negative income tax. Let us call a spade a spade. And Moynihan smiled as he would and said, no, as Oscar Wilde said, one who calls a spade should have to use one. You know, the cabinet, who didn't know the difference, burst out laughing. But we got over a tough moment because Anderson was right. It was a negative income tax.
And Nixon didn't care. Nixon brought no particularly strong feelings to these things, you're saying.
August 8th, 1969, went on television to announce his program and said to the American people, this is going to cost more than the present program. President to say that. And of course, that was very offensive to Arthur Burns, whose whole theme was to bring down the cost of government.
Stephen Hess, thank you very much for talking with us about your new book. Stephen Hess of the Brookings Institution has written a new book. It's called The Professor and the President.
We're all pretty well acquainted with the big sports stories of racial integration, like Jackie Robinson with the Dodgers or Althea Gibson at Wimbledon. But after the 1964 Civil Rights Act, there were many smaller stories of people who had to be the first black whatever, even when they didn't want to.
No, I wasn't interested in being a pioneer. or making history or doing any of that. That was not, and still isn't, quite frankly, my personality. My attitude was just drop me off at Detroit and leave me to hell alone.
That's Perry Wallace. Today he's a law professor at American University. But in 1966, he helped break the color barrier in college basketball's Southeastern Conference, the SEC, when he played for Vanderbilt University. His story unfolds in a new book called Strong Inside, Perry Wallace and the Collision of Race and Sports in the South. Wallace and his biographer sat down with me to talk about the realities of desegregation.
I mean, I think that we're all used to sort of feel-good sports movies about integration where the music swells because someone makes some sort of very sweet gesture. But have you sat through some sports integration movies and thought, I wish that's what had happened?
Well, I think you put it so very, very well. There's often so much fluff, and it's just kind of nice music, and it swells up, and so on and so forth. But it's a gritty, dirty, ugly business, and most people are not up for it, including the people who lead and govern the institutions. That was true back then, as it is now, on various issues, whether it has to do with violence against women or any number of other challenges, which are the same challenges that they faced back then, by the way. And they are around for the celebration, but not around for the hard part.
What was the hard part? Away games. That's where the integration effort at Vanderbilt collided with the reality of Southern segregationist support. Remember, nationally, pro league basketball and baseball were already integrated. But at the college level, most Deep South schools were holdouts, refusing even to share the court with black players. Wallace's biographer Andrew Marinus says that's the atmosphere Perry Wallace walked into when Vanderbilt traveled to play the University of Mississippi in 1968.
Perry travels down to Oxford, Mississippi, and Perry told me in general, as approaching these trips down to the Deep South, that he looked at them with the deepest sense of dread.
What happened was that in my own mind, and for weeks before and sometimes months before, I'm thinking about that game and wondering what's going to happen because this is the unknown. And the anxiety level rises on the bus going to the plane, on the plane flying down. There's no problem there.
People aren't meeting you at the tarmac, right? Like at the bus like that.
No, they saved it all for the game.
A lot of these were tiny little bandboxes of arenas, tiny little places with crowds that were small enough where you could actually hear what people were saying. So you would have people back in Nashville listening to the games on the radio, including Perry's mother laying in the hospital bed, who could hear what was being directed at Perry.
We're going to kill you. We're going to castrate you. The N-word, coon, jigaboo. People are going to spit on you. They're going to tell you that they're going to lynch you. And there's one scene that stands out forever in my mind, and it is that of what looked like three generations of a family, and all of them were spitting, screaming, calling me names, and threatening me. This was just great sport for them.
And so what happens in this game? In the first half, Perry is hit with an elbow in the face, is bleeding, and is temporarily blinded in his eye. And the referees don't call a foul. They don't even call a stop to the game. And so it's not until the next time the ball rolls out of bounds that the trainer and the manager come out to see Perry, walk him across the court as these people are rising and cheering that Perry's been injured back to the Vanderbilt locker room to be treated. And he remains there at halftime. And as he comes back out, he knows what's about to happen.
See, I'm coming back and having to walk all the way across the court from one end of the court to the other. That period, it might not have lasted any more than 10 or 15 seconds, but it was a lifetime. It's like the comedian Dick Gregory said, yeah, I spent 4 years in Mississippi one night. And I did, too, in that particular night. And in that particular moment, it seemed like a lifetime because they could just focus on me and they rained down on me. And that's what the hatred was like.
Once we've heard stories of civil rights pioneers or people who were at the forefront of integration, we don't hear what happens after. We don't mm-hmm. even hear what happens in the time shortly after mm-hmm. and what kind of emotional toll that it takes. Mm-hmm. And was there a time in the year or two after when you realized, like, I'm really struggling.
Oh, absolutely so. And I think, unless one wants to be naive, necessarily so. Because I wouldn't be sitting here today. I would have committed suicide like Henry Harris, the second black athlete who played in the SEC, who ran jump off building a few years later. Like Nat Northington, who was the first athlete, period, who just left after about a year or so. But there's no question about it. If you don't think you have to heal after getting beat up, you don't know the basics. And I understood that. But I did understand that I needed to give myself time to heal.
Wallace didn't really get support from his teammates. Those games, those experiences, he survived on his own. After graduation, he went up north. He needed a break, he said. Law school and work with the Justice Department followed before he settled here in Washington. But his storied season with Vanderbilt and the SEC, glance around his office and you never know it. Perry Wallace doesn't display a single memento from that time. No trophies, framed jerseys, or even newspaper clippings. Andrew Marinus says it's not the formula story that you might expect.
You know, and there was a formulaic ending that was possible. In Perry's last game, which is against Mississippi State in Nashville, his last basket of his college career is a slam dunk, which was illegal at the time. And it was a game that Perry dedicated to his mother, who had just passed away about a year earlier. And Perry saved the best for last in many ways in this game.
Yeah, that's what I wanted to make a statement. And I had made a promise to my mother. And I kept it best that last game. So I scored, 28 points and 27 rebounds. Nobody's ever heard of that. And the pièce de la résistance was the dunk at the end.
The illegal dunk.
The illegal dunk. And that basically said, well, you know, these segregation laws were illegal laws. They were the law, but they weren't just. And so this is what I think of all those unjust, illegal rules. There it is. Slam dunk.
The book about Perry Wallace, the first African-American basketball player in the SEC, is called Strong Inside. It's written by Andrew Marinus, and it's out now.